Yes, hello everyone. Can you hear me all right?
A bit louder.
A bit louder? Let's put this up here then. I've got a very quiet voice. Is that better?
Yeah.
Better? Happy?
Yeah.
Happy?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, welcome. Welcome to the Dharma Parlour. This whole part of the festival, there's several different structures, is the Dharma Parlour. And we've got a whole bunch of different talks and workshops and events here. So just have a look at our programme if you haven't seen it already. But this space is the marquee, where there's basically various different talks on different sorts of Buddhism happening. And each one will be followed by any sort of discussion that we want, questions, answers, whatever. And hopefully it's on quite a range of different themes. So the one this morning, as Steve said, was absolutely packed out, partly because it was raining, partly because it was called Sex, Love and the Transformation of the Heart. Absolutely packed. This one, slightly more boring title, slightly less people, slightly less rain, is by me, and it's called Dharma Doorways and Dead Ends. Dharma Doorways and Dead Ends. And you probably know the theme of the festival. Every year the Buddhafield Festival has a theme. And the theme of this year's festival is Doorways to Freedom. So each year Buddhafield thinks of something that might feel relevant, you know, to where it's at the time, and bases its whole season around that. And this year the whole theme was Freedom and Doorways to Freedom. Last year they had quite a kind of fundraising effort going on to try and buy some land, and the theme was abundance. So last year abundance, the colour was gold. You know, this year, Doorways to Freedom, and the colour is blue. Because in Buddhism, blue symbolises the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, which is the colour of the blue sky, which is kind of limitlessness and openness and no boundaries, no limits. So that's why it's blue. But Doorways to Freedom kind of picks up a very classic but not especially well-known Buddhist teaching, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, but then I also want to talk mostly about, in a sense, a whole bunch of things which are not doorways to freedom. They might look like doorways to freedom, but they're not doorways to freedom. And I find this territory fascinating. I find it fascinating because it's so, almost like seductive. It could be the real thing, it looks like the real thing, it says it's the real thing, it's not the real thing. It doesn't really lead you to freedom. So a bit about doorways, and then a bit about what I call dead ends. Yeah, so if you've read the program, the Buddhafield program, it talks about three doorways to freedom, picking up this classic Buddhist teaching. And generally, when you see them written down in Buddhist books, they're really quite hard to understand. They're all translated in rather inscrutable translations. But Buddhafield, or someone, has come up with three very nice, evocative translations. So the first doorway is mystery. Mystery. Just kind of seeing you can't pin life down. You can't nail it down. Even if you try and fix it, it won't fix. It won't stand still. Things are impermanent. Because they're impermanent, they're changing. Because they're changing, they're mysterious. That's the first of the Buddhafield doorways to freedom. The second one is letting go. You can't control things. You can try as hard as you like, and we generally do, try and control things, but you can't control things. And so in the face of that, what can you do? You can let go into kind of allowing things to sort of be as they are, and then change sort of according to their nature. And that's a fascinating area, I'll come back to it, because it doesn't mean being passive and wishy-washy and a doormat and so on. But they've talked about letting go, or equanimity, and just being with things as they are. And then the third one, they've called limitlessness. Limitlessness. It's like we think of ourselves as having a certain identity. I am me and you are you. He is he and she is he is he and she is she and so on. And we kind of put things in boxes with labels and we know where we are and it's all very clear. But because it's clear, it's limited. So it says, actually, life isn't like that. We are not as fixed and clear as we think we are. Even the boundary of where we kind of stop and where you start is not as clear as we think we might like to think. So they talk about limitlessness. So I find these three very evocative words: mystery, letting go, and limitlessness. But the Buddhist teaching kind of talks about doorways to freedom in all sorts of ways. And I suppose it starts from the Buddha. I mean, most Buddhist things start from the Buddha. And the Buddha just walked about India 2,500 years ago, basically bumping into people, more or less at random, and speaking to them. But what you get when you read the Buddhist stories is he spoke to them in very, very different ways, using very, very different metaphors, and drawing out very, very different teachings to different people. So he'd meet a king, and he'd talk about how to be the kind of best king and sort of rule your domain and sort of order things properly, because that's probably what kings want to hear about. He'd meet a warrior, and he'd talk about how to be on your guard against the demons that could attack you at any time. You know, it's all kind of fierce metaphors of vigilance and determination and so on. He'd meet a mother, and he'd talk to her about the love for her child, you know, and extending it to all beings. He'd meet someone who was a beggar, and just, you know, talk to them about the freedom of having nothing, and so on, and so on, and so on. He'd meet goat herds, or shepherds, and talk to them about training your mind is like herding sheep. You sort of find ways to get them all going in the same direction. So basically, he was offering them all different paths to, you know, the goal of enlightenment, which they could follow in their situation. That was the whole thing. So right from the beginning of Buddhism, there's this notion that we are different, sometimes very different, and we each can move forward in different ways. You know, picking up different teachings, focusing on different things, but sort of going in the same direction, or not even to the same direction, at least going to the same point. I mean, some people might be going north or south, but you might all be going to London to make it geographical. You might have come here from London or Exeter and headed in very different directions, but we've all got here. So his teachings might encourage people sort of to do different things, but because they are different people. So that this notion goes right back to the beginning of Buddhism, I think. Later on, different schools of Buddhism arose. One is the Mahayana. They had a tendency to kind of exaggerate everything. So they talked about 84,000 different Dharma doors, which you can follow in 84,000 different ways according to 84,000 different types of beings. Come in if you want to. There's plenty of room around the sides or at the front. So yeah, the same principle, just Mahayana exaggeration. And I've always liked this notion of Dharma doors. I've always personally found the notion of the path, which we do talk about, as a bit one-dimensional. It's a bit like we all kind of shuffle along in unison, like little kids in nursery school crossing the road. The path sounds a bit one-dimensional. But 84,000 Dharma doors sounds wide open. You know, what is your Dharma door, and so on. One of my favourite Buddhist scriptures is not particularly well known, but it's fantastic. I recommend it. It's called the Avatamsaka Sutra. The Avatamsaka Sutra translates as flower ornament. It's something like 3,000 pages long. You can buy it in translation. And the first 100 pages, literally, is describing who is there when the Buddha is sitting there about to do something, about to teach. And it goes through every single possible type of being you could imagine, starting with humans, but just branching out into spirits of all sorts. And then each of these different types of spirits kind of comes forward and greets the Buddha and says you're welcome and describes how they practice. And there's so many of them, and they have so many different types of practice, it takes 100 pages, and I just love it. So for instance, there's city spirits, whatever they are, earth spirits, mountain spirits, forest spirits, herb spirits, crop spirits, night spirits, day spirits, Kanara kings, Yaksha kings, Naga kings, moon deities, sun deities, thunderbolt spirits, rain spirits, etc., etc., ocean spirits, all sorts. So it's just like the heavens are full of beings, and they all practice in different ways. And I love it. It's just, and I'll read you a couple of them, actually. Just, it doesn't kind of explain what they mean. It just says so-and-so practices in such and such a way. So one of them is a celestial king, the Eye of Pure Virtues, that's his name. He found the door of liberation, of effortless action, knowing that all things are not born, do not perish, and do not come and go. Another celestial king, delightful great knowledge, found the door of liberation, going everywhere in the 10 directions to preach the truth, yet without moving and without relying on anything. There's a crop spirit called Wonderfully Adorned Circular Topknot. They have great names, these spirits. Wonderfully Adorned Circular Topknot, you can visualize it, can you? Found the door of liberation by causing the flower of sentient beings everywhere to bloom. There's another one, a crop spirit called Everywhere Producing Roots and Fruits. Found the door of liberation, revealing the Buddha's field of blessings and causing seeds planted there not to spoil. And it goes on and on and on. So the principle is there are multiple Dharma doors. There really are all sorts. Because we are so varied, we can practice in different ways. And part of our kind of personal challenge, if you get serious about the spiritual life, is to kind of work out where you are, to start with, see yourself clearly, and then work out how to move forward from there. And that's like a path. But it's not, I'll come back to this later, it's not kind of make it up as you go along, because we are all trying to get to the same sort of place. So the Buddha's mission was to help people reach enlightenment. And enlightenment itself is quite multifaceted, but there's a kind of unity to enlightenment. It's not my enlightenment and your enlightenment and his and her enlightenment. It's a bit like, we're heading to London, multiple ways to get there, multiple ways to talk about London, and yet it's not Exeter or Sheffield or Yeovil or anywhere like that. So that's, you can imagine going to London and it means different things to different people, but we get there in different ways. So we're trying to get to enlightenment, but also, kind of as we get there, we're trying to do it in harmony. So it's not a kind of individualistic, this is me doing my thing sort of thing, because Buddhism's always put a strong emphasis on community. And one thing I love about Buddhafield is it is a strong community of all sorts of random people who've come from different places, but something unites us. Something quite deep, quite strong, unites us. And, so even though we've got these different Dharma doors, there's a unity to our community and a kind of unity to our goal. So Buddhafield, I hope, exemplifies that really well, actually. But Buddhafield's part of the wider Buddhist world, the wider Buddhist community, which hopefully exemplifies it too. And specifically, Buddhafield is part of Triratna. Triratna is one amongst various Buddhist schools in England, in the West. And Triratna has all sorts of different centres, different businesses, different communities, different kind of styles, if you like, of which Buddhafield is one. And I'll just read you a couple of kind of quotes by one of Triratna's authors, where he describes the type of community we're trying to create, because I think it holds true for Buddhism, for Buddhafield too. And I find it very moving, to be authentically myself and part of a community of others who are also trying to be authentically themselves. So we don't all merge and become clones. There's a kind of unity in diversity. So this is an order member called Subhuti. Probably not many of you have met him, because he lives up a mountain now, in Wales, and only comes down from his mountain to go to India. So unless you are in Wales or India, you probably haven't met him. But he's very influential anyway. And he says two things. He says the whole attempt of the order, which is the Triratna Buddhist order, if you like, is to create a community of people, of men and women, who are in harmony with each other. And attempting not only to gain a greater and greater harmony amongst themselves, to overcome the split between us, which we all experience, but to expand that harmony outwards to meet more and more people in the world. And it's a small part, what we're doing in the order, is a small part, an aspect, of an attempt to bring about a kind of harmony of life, an overall harmony for all consciousness. So, I love that. And he says the harmony of the order is not just a question of organisational integrity, having the biggest order to be the most powerful or influential or whatever. That is not the point at all. The point is by including more and more people, it kind of, I'm not quite reading it anymore, it challenges us more and more deeply to kind of go beyond ourselves, to be able to empathise with others, to experience this harmony at a deeper and deeper level. And the more people there are, the greater the challenge becomes, because the more diverse the order becomes. And the more diverse the order becomes, the kind of richer the harmony is when you get there. So it's quite a kind of ambitious project to find your own individual Dharma door or path, and then to be part of this community of other individuals. So that's our kind of goal, you know, to reach enlightenment by building a community that we can kind of be ourselves in and be in harmony with others in. And there's 84,000, or probably 84,000 million billion Dharma doors, but not all doorways lead to the same place. So this is the real kind of substance of my talk. Not all doors lead to the same place. It's a bit like, I mean, come back to London and roads. It's a bit like a million roads lead to London. But not every road leads to London. It's obvious when you think about it, but you can kind of easily get confused in your head. So you go down the A3, heading west. Is it west? East. East, thank you. Go east on the A303, you get to London. But go in the other direction on the A303, you get down to Cornwall. Not all roads lead to London. Not all pathways or Dharma doors lead to enlightenment. So what I want to do now is kind of pick up all kinds of qualities. There's so many qualities we can kind of find attractive and be developing. I just kind of explore them. And explore them by asking, well, what is the real deal? What is the true quality we might want to be developing? And then what is, you know, the kind of the dead ends, the kind of false qualities that might lead us astray, that are not the Dharma doors. And the kind of Buddhist term for this is, well, the qualities to start with, but then the near enemies of the qualities. There's this phrase in Buddhism, near enemy. I don't know if you've heard it. It's quite an evocative phrase for me, a near enemy. So you can take a quality, love, compassion, joy, happiness, faith, whatever, whatever, and then ask, well, what is close to it and not it? And that's, it's a near enemy. And it's dangerous because you can get so easily misled by thinking it is it, but it is not it. So the far enemy is the exact opposite, love, hate. Kind of obvious. Not many people muddle up love and hate. But love and various other things I'll talk about in a second, you can muddle up. So there's all these Dharma doors cultivating all these qualities leading to enlightenment, and sort of around them in a sort of haze of confusion or something is the near enemies. So, and this goes back, again, right back to the kind of time of the Buddha. The Buddha loved, or Buddhism generally, loves kind of discriminating things. It loves taking something and really looking at it and really asking, what is this thing? You know, what is the real thing we're talking about? So I'll just take a few. You could take anything and think about it in this way. And one thing I'd encourage you is to take anything that inspires you and look at it and ask yourself, what is the kind of real authentic quality that I'm inspired by, and how could I be getting it wrong? How could I kind of be slightly off target? Maybe that'll come up in the questions or discussion afterwards. So I'll start with a big one. Love. Obviously love is a great thing to cultivate. love. Nobody's going to argue with cultivating love. The near enemy of, the far enemy is hate, something like hate. Very different. But what is love? When you say love, love is the answer. Love is all you need. Love is this, love is that. You know, a million cliches around love. What do we mean? And what might be a near enemy to love? And I suppose the way I find it easiest to think about is to take the English word, love in this case, and first of all go backwards to one or another Buddhist word, because then I sort of know where I am. I can think about it, okay, Buddhism talks about this, and then you sort of reflect on that. So we'll start with love, then we'll go backwards to a Buddhist word, metta. Metta. If you've learnt meditation with us, you've almost certainly done a meditation for developing metta. The metta bhavana means the development of metta. So metta means love. But it's interesting, I personally don't like the word love. If anybody says, I love you, especially if they say, I love you, I sort of think, oh yeah, what do you want? I've got this kind of very wary reaction to love. I either think they want something, or I kind of just want to run a mile. So I personally find the word love almost slightly creepy. I think it's partly because it has got a whole range of meanings which is not the same as metta. So metta, love, but it's a kind of... the best translation I know for metta is universal loving-kindness. Universal loving-kindness. Sangharakshita, who's my teacher, or the founder of Triretna, talks about metta as the absolute affirmation of another person's being. It is not erotic love, or parental love, or even friendly love. If it is love at all, it is a cherishing, protecting, maturing love, which has the same effect on the spiritual being of others as the light and heat of the sun, the light and heat of the sun, has on their physical well-being. So it just makes you kind of glow. It just helps you grow. It just affirms you. And it's nothing to do with desiring you. It's nothing to do with wanting something from you. It's nothing to do with, wanting a relationship or anything. It's just, I love you. I desire the best for you. And I think, I was also thinking about it, it's like the love of a good parent to their children. Obviously parents love their children, but a good parent leaves their children free, especially when they're growing up, just to go, just to leave them and find their place in the world. So there's no kind of you must be mine forever sort of feeling in love, or metta anyway. So that's a great quality, and I wish, you know, I would love more of it. But what might be the kind of near enemies to metta, or to love rather, to metta? And the main one Buddhism talks about, and we might find others in our own experience, is another Buddhist-y word called pema. So you've got metta, pema. Pema is translated as sticky affection. Sticky affection. So kind of try that in your mind. How does that feel? Sticky affection. You could translate it sentimental attachment. That's another translation. It's just got a very different flavour. It doesn't feel so healthy. It's sticky and it's attached and it's a bit, you know, tacky and so on. So that's a near enemy to metta, or to love. Sticky affection. I think another one is the whole field of romance, romantic love. You know, as shown in pretty much any pop song. You know, I can't sing, I'm not going to try. But kind of romantic, idealised, rose-tinted, soft focus, vague projection, blah blah blah, which you hardly even notice the real person. You're in love with love, quite likely. And the real person is rather a shock when you finally bump into them. So, yes. What I'm going to do is talk about this quite briefly, but other things might come to your mind, and so in the kind of discussion afterwards, let's see what you think. because I think there's multiple near enemies to pretty much anything. So another one, we've done love. Let's take compassion. Compassion is a fantastic Buddhist quality. Compassion. And again, it's a doorway. You know, if you focus on compassion and really develop compassion, you will be heading rapidly to enlightenment. Just the same as if you focus on metta. The Buddhist word for compassion, this is going backwards to a Buddhist term, is karuna. Karuna. And there's a lovely way of talking about karuna, a similar word, anukampa, is kind of vibrating with. So you sort of, you really feel for the person. You sort of feel in sympathy with them. I don't know if that is evocative for you, but it is for me. Compassion is said to be the response of metta to suffering. So you start off with love, just this affirming, universal, positive love. Then you might meet somebody who's suffering, and out of that love, you just immediately feel compassion. You don't need to think about it. In a sense, it's not a new emotion. It's just love becomes compassion when it meets suffering. So, again, Buddhism has this lovely kind of role model of the Bodhisattva, of these sort of archetypal beings you see in Buddhist paintings, who are just meant to be archetypes of compassion, kind of responding to suffering wherever they see it in the world. But again, there's near enemies to compassion. So there's two I can mention, and I don't know the kind of Sanskrit for these, but one is, instead of the real deal of compassion, there's pity. So pity. So imagine somebody who's suffering. Imagine you're a kind of Victorian vicar, and you sort of go along and pat them on the head. Dear child, you know, accept some charity from me. Here's a place in the workhouse. It's a response, a very patronizing response. There is suffering, you are responding to it, that's really nice, but you're really kind of patronizing them. You're not really empathizing. You're sort of, almost sort of keeping them down by patting them on the head. And there's quite a separation between you and them. So call it pity, call it something else, but this is a kind of little description of what a near enemy might be. A sort of patronizing, there, keep a little distance type of response. Another response, another near enemy, is often translated horrified anxiety. So imagine, I don't know, you're going along, and there's a road accident, and it's really shocking and quite bloody, and you haven't got a clue what to do, because you're not a paramedic, but there it is right in front of you. And you might stop, and you might rush over there, but you might easily go into horrified anxiety, where you're really, really responding, because you're really, really, you know, reacting, but you're not actually helping very much, you're just having your own reaction. And it's called horrified anxiety, yeah. And it's not compassion, because it's too sort of self-centered. It's all about you, in a sense. Your horrified anxiety, and it's not helping the suffering person at all, really. And it might be because you don't know what to do, which is human enough, but it might be because you can't handle the emotion, you can't really handle the feeling of being so close to that pain, the pain of the suffering. So that's just two kind of classic near enemies to karuna, compassion. But you can think, you know, I'm really, really compassionate because I get really, really disturbed or affected by suffering. But it could be horrified anxiety. Or you could be this Victorian vicar, always doing good works for the poor, but it all could be a bit patronising. So, that's karuna. Then another one, a lovely quality, joy. Joy. Fantastic. Joy, or sympathetic joy, is often said to be the natural response of love to happiness. So imagine you've got this love for people. Imagine you meet somebody and life is great. They are happy. They're not suffering, they're happy. The natural human response out of your love is just to feel delighted. How lovely that you are happy. is joy. But it's quite a difficult emotion for us to feel, because it challenges us, you know, have you got what they've got? Are you happy? You've got to be quite free of self-preoccupation to really rejoice in another person's good fortune. Might be their promotion, might be their successful love life, it might be their good health, it might be their beautiful, whatever, whatever. It's quite a challenge to you to rejoice in their good fortune. So joy is a great quality. Obviously the opposite, the far enemy, is envy, or let's say envy. The Sanskrit is mudita, mudita. So it's just a feeling of joy and gladness in the happiness and well-being of others. So what might be a near enemy or two to joy? Where it looks like the real thing, but it's not really the real thing, it's not really joy. So one I've come across is I'd like to call it groupiness. Groupiness. You kind of hang out with the stars. You want to be around this person because they are so great. They might be film star literally, or they might just be successful and have that aura about them, and you want to be with them because you sort of feed off their aura almost. So I'm calling it groupiness because that's what groupies do. They hang out with their stars, and it's not the real thing, because you are sort of feeding off them. And crucially, you're not trying to develop their qualities for yourself. You're like a kind of parasite. They are performing, they are getting promoted, they're doing this and that, and you're kind of feeding off them. So you might think, I'm so happy they are the world's greatest, but you're just hanging out with them. Yeah. Yeah. I think, parents can do this through their children. They really want their children to succeed, and obviously they are really happy when their children succeed, but there can be a sort of subtle living through your children. Your children are doing all the things you never did, and you're not going to try anymore. And then it all gets a bit messy, because you're actually putting a certain pressure on them to do this and that and the other. So it's not as clean as, the real thing. So, with each of these, we can kind of ask ourselves, you know, what's my relationship to this quality? I'll take another one. Equanimity. So equanimity is another Buddhist quality, which is a bit harder to talk about. One translation I like of it is unshakability. You just cannot be blown around. Anything can happen, sun, rain, winds, earthquakes, whatever, but you're sort of solid, you're just in the middle of it, you're unshakable. One of the best descriptions of it I heard is that not that you're kind of cool and calm and above it all, but that you have the emotional muscle to kind of cope with whatever life throws at you. You don't kind of cut off it and rise above it. You can sort of cope with joy, cope with suffering, cope with loss, cope with success, whatever. And you're not blown away by it, and you're not kind of ground down by it. So one description is equanimity is a positive awareness, big enough and broad enough to take on board awareness of suffering and joy without being shocked out of your own positivity. It's a bit like you can hold the pain of the world without, sinking. And for Buddhism, equanimity has got a kind of underpinning of insight. You just know all things are impermanent. You just know all things are unreliable. And you're kind of cool with that. And therefore, you're not blown around when things change. So equanimity is a great quality. I think in English the word has a slight connotation of being, you know, a bit sort of cool, a bit sort of disinterested maybe, but it should be much more positive than that. It should be much more you can hold it without cracking. So anyway, what is the near enemy of equanimity? Obviously the far enemy is where you absolutely have no cool. You're completely blown around by anything that happens. It just sends you off into a tizz. So the near enemy is where you do keep your cool, but in the wrong sort of way. Maybe in a slightly alienated way. You're just, nothing really touches you. You're just a bit numb. Pink Floyd had that phrase, comfortably numb. Do you know it? Takes you back. Comfortably numb. There's nothing really touches you. And you might even turn it into it looking quite spiritual. You go around with a shaven head and nothing really touches you. But actually you're a bit numb. Yes, and you're just not really connected with life, which is going on around you and you're seeing it, but you're just not really connected. And I came across a fantastic book talking about engaged Buddhism and how a Buddhist can engage in the world, called The Engaged Spiritual Life. The Engaged Spiritual Life. And he's got a whole section on equanimity and how, on the near enemies of equanimity. So the classic classic near enemy, as well as this numbness, is just indifference. You just don't really care, quite frankly. So you look cool, but you're just indifferent. But he kind of explores it very much for our world today. And he comes up with all sorts of near enemies that we might find. So one is denial. It's not really happening. So take climate change, let's say. If you really think about climate change, it's pretty big and pretty scary. The whole, the whole planet might be cooking itself. And denial is a great way of keeping your cool, where, you're actually in denial. Another one is complacency. These are all from the book, The Engaged Spiritual Life. Another one is complacency. I'm sure they will sort it out. The government will do something. Another one is resignation. What can I do? You know, you sort of shrug your shoulders. What can I do? And again, you're just sort of keeping it at a distance and not really, not really connected. Another one is rationalizing it, where you sort of think of all sorts of good reasons why it sort of has to be that way, and therefore you're not going to get involved. Another one is, he calls it privileged distance. A privileged distance. Maybe, you can think about us in the third world. Here we are, it's sort of their problem. You know, you don't want to get involved because it's up to them. A privileged distance. Another one is cynicism. You know, you've sort of thought it all through and it can't be any difference, and therefore you're not involved. So there's all sorts of possible near enemies in equanimity. But basically it boils down to not being connected with other people, and therefore not being connected with their suffering or joy. And if you can't feel their suffering, you won't feel their joy either. So it kind of numbs you to everything, not just suffering. So all that I could go on and on and on. I'll say a couple more. But in a sense, the principle is that we can think about it for ourselves. We can take anything that, you find inspiring, that might be a Dharma door for us in our practice, and just try and get really, really clear what is it we are attracted to, and then get equally clear what is the, what's the kind of, the near enemies of it. Yeah. So let's try another one. How's the time? So another one, not equanimity, but energy. Energy. So this might look really different. You are full of energy. You are just dead keen on everything. Saving the planet, practicing Buddhism, meditation, retreats, whatever. So energy is a great quality. The more energy we have, the better. But again, energy, tracing it backwards, I would use a Buddhist word called virya, virya, which may well be connected with our words like vital and vigorous and virile and so on. But virya is often translated energy in pursuit of the good. Energy in pursuit of the good. So it's not just random energy rushing around, it's energy in pursuit of the good. And it's got all sorts of kind of positive qualities, like just, you can direct your effort, you've got a discipline to you. You know how to kind of work with positive mental states, you know how to work with negative mental states, you know how to kind of do things when they have to be done. You're just sort of up and running fully. But the opposite, near the far enemy, is lack of energy, sleepiness, doziness, whatever. But a couple of near enemies. One is compulsiveness. You just cannot stop. You're so busy because you can't stop. And behind that is a kind of anxiety. You're driven. And it is energy. It may be doing good things, but there's a compulsiveness behind it, where because you're compulsive, you can't really stop and look at things deeply enough to be sure you're really doing the best thing. Because sometimes the best thing is to do nothing and just sort of leave a bit of space for others to step in or things to unfold. And very likely, this kind of compulsive business is not sustainable. So ideally, our energy is sustainable. And we could just keep going, and have a whole life of well-directed energy. But compulsive energy generally burns itself out, and the person, you just don't see them 2 years later. Yeah. I'll tell you one more, and then I'll conclude. I've got several, actually, but I'll try one more. So, faith. Another fantastic quality. Faith. If you don't have any faith, you're just not going to kind of be motivated to kind of go forwards in a spiritual life. I think if you're ever going to go into unknown territory, which a spiritual life takes you into, you need some sort of faith into why you're going there. Why are you doing this? Some sort of faith. So faith is a great quality. And faith definitely has a big place in Buddhism. The opposite is cynicism. A cynical person is very unlikely to do anything, actually. But faith, trace it backwards, you get to the Buddhist word Shraddha. Shraddha. And Shraddha is kind of about giving something your confidence. But then the question arises, why would you give something your confidence? You wouldn't give it to something randomly. Why give something your confidence? So your faith needs certain grounds to it, and you need to be sure your ground is solid ground. So in Buddhism, faith would generally be based on reason, it makes sense, experience, I know it to be true, or just a kind of intuition, it rings true. So they're all fine. You know, the intuition is the most mysterious, but if it rings true to you, well great, go for it, test it and see. So the three grounds for faith in Buddhism is reason, experience, and intuition. But faith has all sorts of, you know, all sorts of near enemies. So one sort of faith is a kind of piety, where you're very faithful and you do your prayers every day, but you really don't think about things. You sort of piety and religiosity. You're kind of going through all the right motions, looking, you know, like you're very spiritual, but there's no real sort of brains there. You're just not thinking about it. That's linked to another near enemy, credulity. You're full of faith in something or somebody, but you haven't thought about it. You really haven't thought about it. And it might just crumble as soon as you did think about it. So credulity is not faith. Even though you might be looking like you have total faith in somebody, actually you've just been hoodwinked. You haven't based your faith on your reason, apart from anything else. Linked to that a bit is fanaticism and fundamentalism. You know, you're full of passion for your chosen cause, but you're fanatical and you're fundamentalist. And often with fanatics and fundamentalists, their faith is so fragile they cannot afford any sort of doubt to creep in whatsoever. and they cannot afford anyone around them to voice any sort of doubt either, because they have to preserve this, you know, feeling of faith, fanaticism at all costs. So they can't bear other people voicing dissent. That leads into evangelism and crusading and all sorts of other unhelpful things faith can lead to. So that's faith. There's the sort of emotional near enemy to faith, piety and sort of sentimentality. And there's the intellectual near enemy to faith, where you're just not thinking about it properly, and you're sort of fanatic and fundamentalist. So, I could go on and on and on actually. There's probably 84,000 spiritual qualities, each one of which is fantastic, but each one of which has 84,000 near enemies. We'd be here for ages. Just one more little one. The Buddha. Think of the Buddha. Hopefully we are inspired by the Buddha. But when we are inspired by it, you know, what are we thinking of? And I think too often when we think of the Buddha, we do think of somebody who's very calm, equanimous, but he's basically sitting there with his eyes closed doing nothing. So our image of the Buddha, or enlightenment, can be of sitting down with your eyes closed doing nothing, which doesn't really do justice to enlightenment. It doesn't do justice to the Buddha. The word Buddha means he who has woken up. So sitting with your eyes closed is the wrong direction. Buddha means waken up. So if you're meditating, ideally you're waking up inside, but we might well be thinking of a near enemy which is, you know, just a bit passive, a bit spaced out, a bit aloof. So, I hope you've got the idea of near enemies. I think this is not a kind of definitive list to learn in any sense. It's a kind of way of thinking. So the way of thinking is to find out where you are, be really honest, find out a path, you know, that is going to take you forwards, which may be quite personal, and then find a community to do that with. This may be Butterfield or another community, and then look at your path and its possible near enemies. You know, are you really making progress on a kind of authentic spiritual path in harmony with others, or are you getting it wrong a little bit in some way or not? It's just a good question to ask. And I think it's a bit like sailing a boat. If you're sailing a boat, you're always getting it wrong, slightly, this way, that way, this way, that way. And it's fine. You just kind of tack, don't you? You kind of sail from side to side and go forwards. But unless you're conscious of which direction you're heading, you might just go further, 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 kind of out to sea. So I've mentioned a bunch of love, compassion, joy, equanimity, energy, faith, Buddhahood, whatever. And in a sense, the last words I've written down here is the rest is up to us. The rest is up to us. At the end of the day, nobody can make any progress on the spiritual path except each of us, one by one by one. But kind of getting clear where we want to go is not the first step, but it's a great preliminary to the first step. Yes. So thank you very much. That is my talk.